The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week we meet British actor James Darcy to discuss his portrayal of Edward the Abdicating King in Madonna's directorial debut, W.E. And Homer's Odyssey is radically reinvented in an idiosyncratic cinema project, The Nine Muses. I meet its creator, the British auteur and artist, John Acomfra. Guardian critic Zan Brooks will be along as we review some of the week's other releases, including Steven Soderbergh's action thriller Haywire, Jonah Hill in The Sitter, and Leonardo DiCaprio as J. Edgar Hoover in J. Edgar. Yes, it sits proudly on its podcast throne. It's Film Weekly. To some extent, it came as little surprise that Madonna would take to the director's chair, having in both her personal and professional life become entwined with cinema to varying degrees of success. This week sees the UK debut of that ambition with W.E., a dual narrative that draws on a present-day obsession with a love story of King Edward VII and the American Mrs. Wallis Simpson. It stars Andrea Risborough as Wallis Simpson and James Darcy as King Edward VII, and their laudable performances keep the film from tipping into chaos as their story is mirrored in the modern-day strand by Abbie Cornish, who plays a young Manhattanite obsessed by the W.E. love story. I met up with British actor James Darcy, a relative unknown here getting a huge break from Madonna, to find out how this love story will mean many things to different audiences.
Lunch with your brother and sister-in-law.
They are rather dull, aren't they?
They'll never accept me.
We're going to let Bertie and Elizabeth dictate our future.
It isn't just Bertie and Elizabeth, it's everyone.
It won't be once we're married.
David, let's stop all this talk about marriage. It frightens me and I can't see any good coming of it.
Why?
Your family will never stand for it. The Prime Minister won't stand for it.
Then I'll give up the throne.
And I will be the most despised woman in the world.
James Darcy, star of W.E., welcome to Film Weekly. Congratulations on your performance as the king who gave it all up for love.
Thanks very much.
You knew that you were playing this man, and there are so many different facets to this man. He was either a romantic hero, did it all for love, or he was a feckless, weak, shameful guy who abandoned Britain in its hour of need.
Well, I think it's a really interesting story, and particularly interesting because we now, as modern-day people, if we think of that story, we maybe get it in three sentences. We sort of have big headlines: King abdicates throne for twice divorced American woman. That's sort of all I knew, to be honest. And obviously, being British, we see it from the perspective of, well, that's dereliction of duty. I mean, he was supposed to serve his country. That's what he was born to do. The Americans see it completely differently. They see it as the greatest love story of all time. And that is a generalization. Of course, there are people in Britain who see it that way too.
Do you think that says more about the difference between Britons and Americans? Do we view life differently? Are we that sort of... We don't have romance running through us generally in Britain.
I think it might have something to do with the propaganda that happened very quickly after he abdicated, because there was a new king and because there was the threat of a world war. The then Prime Minister, Stanley Baldwin, had to make sure that the country fell in behind that new king, who hadn't been groomed to be king. They weren't expecting him.
And he wasn't very good at speaking, apparently.
So I've heard. So I think that might have more to do with the propaganda than anything else. You know, it's unquestionable that he must have been madly in love with her in order to give up this role to which he had been born to, and had expected to fulfil his whole life.
And was kind of up for fulfilling it as well. In Bertie, as played by Colin Firth, wasn't really expecting it and didn't really fancy it. But you must have been groomed for it, not you personally. Although I think you would do very well
upon. Thanks. Yeah, no, I would give it a shot. You know, why not? I think he was groomed for it his entire life. And there's a sort of interesting footnote to this, which is that I met some royal advisers, and they told me that traditionally, throughout history, the advisers have always looked to whoever the Prince of Wales is and gone, oh no, this one's going to really fuck it up. He's going to be terrible. This one isn't going to work at all. And then they go on and become king and have been fantastic. The one exception was Edward, where they all went, he's going to be amazing. He's going to be the greatest king. And, of course, he didn't even manage a year.
Due to the gorgeousness of Andrea Riseborough, or Wallace Simpson, as it is. In a way, I mean, I suppose this film coming out, and it wasn't that far when it first kind of appeared, Wills and Kate were getting married, a new prince was doing it, and in a way we were led to believe, or we hope to believe, that that is a true love story, one of those rare true love stories in royal circles, that they actually, he's married a commoner, I believe she's called. You know, that's a real story. Was there a closeness? Then you said you met with the royal advisors. Obviously, William has gone through this kind of thing. He will one day be king. You can sort of appreciate the world that he's come from.
I certainly got a very small sort of glimpse into what it might be like. There's a lot of pomp and circumstance, and there's a lot of protocol, and it is quite constricting, you know, and that's even from my tiny little perspective of living that life. You know, there's a lot of people who are following you around, telling you exactly what's going to happen next and how you're going to behave and what you're going to do. And what was interesting about Edward was he was the first of the royal family really to step outside of that and to start saying things that were not expected, you know, and still today, if Prince Charles says something that is outside of his remit, that's front page headlines, you know. So if you can imagine 80 years ago, the Prince of Wales saying that, it was huge. But the common man, the commoners, as you rightly say, they all loved him for it. They loved that finally there was somebody in the monarchy who was standing up for them.
In your research for it, James, what did you discover about him? Was this a real love story? I mean, he must have liked it quite a lot.
I think there was the one certainty, and there's a huge amount of material to look through, a lot of it very contradictory, but the one certainty was that he was completely and utterly possessed by her. I mean, he was totally tunnel vision in terms of his love for her, and I had some understanding of how that felt. You know, when you meet somebody and suddenly the rest of the world just falls away and it's only them and you can't see anything else. And he said it when he abdicated, you know, he felt that he was unable to carry out his duties without her by his side. And it had been made very clear to him that he was not allowed to marry her. So he felt he had no choice but to abdicate.
Did you find out what it was about her that he loved so much? What was it? I mean, there were so many rumours, some of them sexual, some of them, you know, societal, some of them witty. What was it that got him about her?
I think the sexual stuff is probably all bollocks. I feel like that's, you know, just been made up.
No one really would know the answer to that, I suppose, as such.
But there's almost nobody that's saying that it is true. When you really start looking into it, that's just all anecdotal now. There's really nobody seriously is suggesting any of that stuff.
Not a problem, actually. I've just seen Shame by Steve McQueen. And, you know, sex is important. Sex needs to be talked about.
I'm not sure how sexual they were together.
Madonna actually spoke about sex quite candidly herself.
Did she now?
In a book, which I have.
Which in Hungary I discovered the other day is actually called Slut. Where were we?
I don't know. I'm now just seeing Madonna drop from a helicopter with her boobs out. And anyway, but sex, was it a sex thing? Did they just, you know, have great sexual acts that were going to unify them? What was it about Wallace Simpson that got him?
He was an incredibly modern man for the time. He also was a great fashion icon. You know, he brought turnips to Great Britain. He brought the zip on jeans or on trousers to Great Britain.
He should be known for this, not abdicating the throne.
Well, he sort of is known for it. In truth, he is known for it in circles where they talk about, you know, where fashion changed. And she also, obviously, was a great clothes horse. But the other thing that I think they had massively in common was they were very gregarious. You know, she used to use the word pep quite a lot. She had great pep. And I think that is what he really loved about her. She wasn't afraid to speak her mind. She loved throwing parties. She was the world's greatest hostess. And, of course, after he abdicated, they then spent 20 years throwing parties to which the entire world tried to get themselves invited to. So I think that is one of, I mean, that seemed to me to be something. They just gelled really well together.
He was a very fashionable man, and you wear your suits with aplomb, I might say. Cut a dash in your flannels and in the Cap d'Antibes. Where'd you get all that clobber?
Those beautiful, beautiful suits were made for me by a man called Martin Nichols, who I think may be the greatest tailor in the world. And he made them for Dunhill, who sadly now own them. I wish I did, but they...
You've got nothing?
I got nothing.
A pair of socks? Boxer shorts?
I didn't even get a pair of socks. That's exactly right. I got absolutely nothing from the deal. But I am on film wearing them, and they're beautiful, and they make you feel regal, I suppose. Mm.
And I suppose that was it, the straight-jacketed world of the British monarchy at the time. The stiff collars and all of that. Breath of fresh air, in she comes. But, and the hence he could kind of rail against that with a kind of more tailored casual look.
Well, I mean, when he first started wearing turnips, which was absolutely not the done thing in Britain, I think he came, there's a famous story where he came into breakfast one morning and his father, the king, looked at him, looked down at his turnips and said, "What are they for? Is it raining outside?" So, you know, they just didn't get it. Mm. And of course, now, you know, turnips are everybody wears, you know, it's no big deal. But he really changed things and shook things up in a way that you just weren't supposed to do when you were a royal.
Well, the reverberations of his acts are still felt today, and it is a very nice performance that you give. Very pleased to see you in that. And things have obviously gone very well for you, James, because you're now, you don't look anything like Edward, or like, as you do as Edward. You've completely changed. You've just done Cloud Atlas, is that right?
Yeah, I've just wrapped on a... I mean, it's a crazy project. I have real aspiration, real hope for it.
I mean, it was an unfilmable novel. Everyone loved the novel and did well, David Mitchell's novel, but it was like, well, you can't make a film of this.
They do say it's an unfilmable novel. I think that they might, I hope they've made a masterpiece, to be honest.
Who is it?
Who's
making it?
It's being directed and produced by the Wachowskis, who of course did the Matrix films, amongst other things. And
isn't one of them a woman now? Is that another made-up story?
No, one of them is a woman now. It's Andy and Lana Wachowski. So they're directing half the film. The other half of the film is being directed by Tom Tykwer, who directed Perfume and Run Lola Run and The International and lots of things like that. And then they managed to get this unbelievable cast list together. They've got Tom Hanks, Halle Berry, Hugh Grant, Jim Broadbent, Susan Sarandon, Hugo Weaving, Jim Sturgis, Ben Whishaw, me, the most
all in at the same time, or different storylines?
Well, everybody's in it at the same time, and everybody plays multiple roles. So I think Ben's already said this. He plays a woman at one point. Halle Berry plays a white woman at some point. I play somebody who's 70 for much of the film. I was playing Asian in the film.
Is that allowed? We're allowed to do that? Change colours these days? And genders? I suppose they have more of a handle on it than most, the Wachowskis, given what happened there.
Well, I think that given the way the film has been put together, and it's difficult to explain, you'll just have to sort of go and see it. It does make sense. It feels like souls regenerating and just being in slightly different guises. It's a crazy film. I think it could be magnificent.
Yeah, well, I sort of can't wait to see that. But first, that you have to see WE, which is sort of insane in its own way. You know, it's not like that's a straight down the middle story because you've got the other layer, and then there's a bit where you do Pretty Vacant on the Dexedrine, is it? Dexy.
Benzedrine. Everybody takes Benzedrine and dances, and Madonna's overlaid the soundtrack of Pretty Vacant from the Sex Pistols to it. Yeah.
Did you know that she was doing that at the time? Is that what you did the scene to?
I knew she was going to do that because it was in the script, but actually when we shot the scene, I don't think she did play that music. She played something period, some period music, which she also then played at twice the speed, and she played it at half the speed when we were doing it, and she shot it that way as well. But it was always in the script that she was going to put the Sex Pistols over the top of it.
Well, it's a very affecting moment. It works, and much of the music is excellent, actually, throughout the film, as is your performance, and Andrea Risborough's as well, together. Congratulations, James Darcy. Lovely to have you on Film Weekly, and I can't wait to see Cloud Atlas. That sounds the most bonkers film in the world.
Yeah, I think it will be.
Congratulations. And WE is out on general release here in the UK from this Friday, the 20th of January. Now, he's threatened to abdicate many times, but we keep pulling him back in. It's Zan Brooks, who joins me to review some of this week's other releases. Zan, welcome back. Nice
Thank
to have you.
That film made me want to abdicate.
Yeah, I know. All responsibility, I think. but this week, we're going to look at J. Edgar. We'll talk a bit about WE, but we're going to look at J. Edgar, starring Leonardo DiCaprio. Coriolanus, starring, of course, Ralph Fiennes. Haywire, which sees Steven Soderbergh back directing on the big screen again. And maybe Jonah Hill's The Sitter as well. We should not forget Jonah Hill's The Sitter, of course. But let's start with W. We just heard from James Darcy there. I mean, we kind of slaughtered this film from Venice.
Yeah.
Madonna has since been away, rethought
she
it. She's cut a full 45 seconds.
Not
minutes. That would be good.
Yeah.
45 seconds. She kowtowed to popular opinion and cut 45 seconds, which I can't divine from what seeing them again. But it's, you know, is it any better with age?
Well, it's 45 seconds. It's shorter, which is a good thing. I mean, if you're going to have a really horrible operation, you want it to be over as quickly as possible. You want them to, you know, get in, get out and stitch you up nice and quick. And if it's 45 seconds shorter, that's a 45 seconds of my life that I can use to do something
else. Your hatred of the film has not abated.
No, I think it's a thing of woozy, glassy-eyed idiocy. It's it's like a chimp who's raided the perfume counter and dressed up as the queen. I really don't like it.
More of that in J. Edgar, of course.
Of course.
Although no actors were harmed in the making of this movie, none of them are particularly bad. Andrew Risby, James Darcy.
No, they do, you know, full credit to them. They do their level best with some really dreadful material. It's a fawning, servile Valentine to Wallace and also to jewellery and dresses,
yeah,
and it looks
these
like
these are important, Zan. I know.
Well, they're not to me, and maybe they should be. Clearly, they're not to me, and clearly they are to Madonna. But I think if she's any kind of filmmaker, she's got to make a fashion disaster like me at least understand why these things are important.
Quite right.
She doesn't.
I think they're the final word. That is, Zan.
Is that the final word? We can now leave this film to wither
to history
and die.
And see what becomes of it.
That's
talking
good.
Of history, that is what is covered in Clint Eastwood's J. Edgar. Leonardo DiCaprio plays the head of the FBI. Here he is, addressing his staff for the first time as the Bureau's new director.
It is my belief that when a man becomes a part of this Bureau, he must so conduct himself, both officially and unofficially, as to eliminate even the slightest possibility of criticism as to his conduct. You still fancy facial hair, Agent Stokes?
The ladies appreciate it.
Hmm. And I suppose the ladies' opinions are more important than the Bureau's?
No, sir.
Perhaps you are better suited for the police force than the Bureau of Investigations.
I've been with the Department of the Bureau for 7 years, Edgar. Almost as long as you.
No. You were with the old Bureau 7 years, and that Bureau is now gone, sir. And so are you.
Stiff standards, Anne. I'm not sure you'd make it as an FBI agent.
Oh, I don't know. I think I'd be all right. I think I'd go so deep cover that nobody would be able to know what I was.
He himself went deep cover, rather famously, J. Edgar Hoover. After his death, it was known he was a cross-dresser and all of this. Do we get some of that in J. Edgar from Leonardo?
Well, we do a little bit. It's a very strange film, this, because it seems full of ambivalence about Hoover. It doesn't want to go the trashy route. And it's like the whole film is shot through this kind of brown cigar fog that you occasionally get kind of glimpses of the man and some of the more salacious stories about him. But it really won't be drawn on, you know, the specifics of his sexual orientation, even his racism, and his largely kind of malign influence on US politics. It kind of hedges its bets a lot.
It's written by Dustin Lance Black, who was Oscar nominated. I think he might even won for Milk.
He wrote
the script of Milk. He's a gay writer. I mean, and this, in a sense, is a gay love story,
yes,
of unrequited gay
it
love
is.
Story, without a doubt, between Leonardo DiCaprio and Clyde Tolson, or J. Edgar and Clyde Tolson.
Yeah, who's his deputy.
Who's his deputy, and they're sort of sweet old men, you know, in latex masks, eating each other boiled eggs at the end of this.
They are. And the suggestion is that, the romance wasn't necessarily reciprocated by Hoover himself, that he was largely asexual. He's slightly oppressed by his loving mom, played by Judi Dench, in one of the sort of better performances in the film, I think.
And shorter.
And shorter performances. They wind up sort of lathered in latex, tottering about in the 1970s. And, you know, Hoover, of course, was head of the FBI from 1935 right through to 1972. in that time, he did a lot of, I think, generally held as fairly bad things, well, which the film glosses.
The film is... Why make this film? Clint
Eastwood, well, I don't know.
I was watching this film thinking, well, Clint Eastwood, before, I mean, he's played the guy who protects the president. There are a few cavalcades shown in here because he saw eight presidents through.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of...
Well, and there's sort of walk-ons from sort of Nixon to Robert Kennedy.
Yeah,
and
Kennedy. And you, there's bits of Hoover, as played by DiCaprio, on the sort of balcony in Washington watching the presidential cavalcade. And you remember Clint Eastwood was running beside that once
in the
line of
fire. John Malkovich trying to shoot them.
Yeah, exactly. And you're thinking, well, what's Clint Eastwood's position here? You're going to make a film about Hoover, who, you know, persecuted blacks, Jews, may have assassinated Martin Luther King. We don't know. Mm. We still don't know.
What
is Eastwood's
position? I don't know. I think he's ambivalent, and I think that ambivalence is fine, and ambivalence can be interesting about a subject, but not when you've got a structure that's this conventional and this leaden. It's not receptive to that. And I suppose the interpretation I had is that Eastwood has one view of J. Edgar, which is maybe a bit more benign, and Dustin Lance Black has another, which is maybe more criticising of him. And they're kind of pulling in different directions, and the result is... is nothing. The result is a great kind of void.
Yeah. Well, you've got Leonardo DiCaprio, obviously, you know, he's so youthful in his looks.
He's
that
so youthful
have to
in his looks.
Completely look, so, kind of
yeah.
That
inevitably,
up,
he's
up.
At his best in the early sections where he's the kind of the gung ho kind of nerd figure. He's a bit geeky as the head of the FBI, and he's sort of, you know, ahead of his time in terms of forensic science and fingerprinting. He's good in those guises. Less convincing later on.
No, is this a story then of a man who started out with good intentions to create a federal bureau where everyone kind of had fingerprinting and forensics and was designed to, you know, chase Al Capone and Babyface and John Dillinger to go back to Public Enemies and create a law which allowed, you know, which was against the kind of criminals, the underclass.
Yeah.
And it's kind of presented that and Bolsheviks and all of that. I'm not sure whether this is a man who's gone awry because of his closeted
homosexuality. No, I'm not sure either. And that's very dangerous when you're tackling a subject like Hoover because what you're left with, you know, the message I took away from this film was that, you know, all of the racism, the hounding of the American left, the tolerance of the mafia, the vandalism of sort of civil liberties, all of that didn't really matter because he invented fingerprinting.
Yeah.
And you think, I don't give a damn that he did invent fingerprinting, even if he did, which I don't think he did. And so you can't get away with that kind of bland whitewash of a character like this.
It seemed to me, I mean, I know everyone's outraged by the whitewash involved in The Iron Lady and Thatcher.
Yeah.
This seemed to me much more criminal
with
its whitewashing. I was outraged by this.
I think you're right. You know, this is not a pleasant individual. And it's fine to search for the humanity of this man, because, you know, of course he did have a humanity. He was a real person with issues, but you've got to do it a bit more responsibly than this kind of walking waxwork of a film.
Yeah, that's J. Edgar by Clint Eastwood. Not so sure we liked that one. Zan, we shall turn instead to Coriolanus, which sees Ralph Fiennes directing for the first time, a play he knows very well, having starred in it in 2000 here on the London stage. Here he plays Coriolanus as well and directs, and here he has a whole cast of familiar faces to give Shakespeare the Hurt Locker treatment.
You speak of the people as if you were a god to punish, not a man of their infirmity.
It were well we let the people know.
Were
it.
I as patient as the midnight sleep, by Jove, it would be my mind.
It is a mind that shall remain a poison where it is, not poison any further.
Shall remain. Hear you, this triton of the minnows, mark you, his absolute shall.
Why should the people give one that speaks thus their voice?
I'll give my reasons more worthier than their voices.
I had Rafe on the show last week. You've interviewed him yourself about this film. You're quite fond of this?
Yeah, I thought this was very good.
Cool, isn't it?
And I went in with a slight prejudice. I'm always a little bit suspicious of Shakespeare in modern dress, because it's sort of, I don't know what it is. It's always suggests to me a sort of slightly earnest teacher trying to win over bored sixth formers by saying, look, Shakespeare's cool.
Yeah, they wore jeans.
They wore jeans. They had spoken to mobile phones. It's not just the past. It's relevant now.
And you know, if you're doing Macbeth now, you'd have the three witches up on, like, you know, on one would be on Skype, it would be on Instant Messenger, and they'd be chatting.
They'd be emo.
Yeah. Let's do the show right here.
But this did win me over and won me over very quickly. Mm. I think it's made with real panache, a real sweaty, muscular panache to this film.
Not what you'd think from Ralph Fiennes.
No,
you know,
really
directors
not.
Directors put their souls up, especially when they go with what they know on their debut.
Yeah.
I'd have thought we'd at least get a kind of rather pinched kind of costume drama of some sort. But this is tough stuff.
It is. And he's convincing as this almost sort of General Mladic figure with the shaven head and the shoulders sort of stippled with scar tissue. And it only took me a few minutes to actually think, oh, but that's just, you know, lovey Rafe poncing around. And then I was completely convinced by him in this role.
Yeah.
As, you know, the great man who's dragged down by the minnows, the tribunes, and he won't play politics. And his mother, another very good performance by Vanessa Redgrave, sort of, you know, engineering his rise to the top, but he cannot play that game. And so because of that, he's cast out and throws in his lot with the rebel leader, Ophidius, played by Gerard Butler.
Yeah. Who they fight and they go through glass windows. And do a lot of... I mean, it is one of those kind of wish fulfillment. I'll take on Jerry Butler. I mean, Little Rafe, he wouldn't really.
No, he'd get his
ass
kicked, wouldn't he?
He would, definitely.
And you know, you've got Brian Cox in there, who's very good. You've got Jon Snow as...
A lot of Jon Snow.
A lot of Jon Snow as the news anchor speaking in rhyming couplets and saying things like, I never saw the like. and again, it flirts with being a little bit... gimmicky, but again,
like when they say soft, who comes here, and it's just means quieting down. I'm going to try and watch telly, the news on telly, and it kind of filters it quite well. I mean, I thought it was very smartly done and quite exciting as well. Lots of explosions and stuff.
Yeah, and a proper study of a character. It manages both things. It manages to be a tough, gritty, guerrilla-style action movie, and a portrait of a man who cannot adapt.
Some nice writing in there. This.
John Logan?
Well, there's John Logan. There's also William Shakespeare,
isn't
it? He's carrying Shakespeare.
Yeah,
but I think he'll go far, this fella. We've not heard the last of Shakespeare. We shall not look upon his like again, perhaps.
Oh, very good, James.
Thank you very much.
Your A-level English coming in.
Shall we look upon the like of Steven Soderbergh again? Because he's taking a forced break from filmmaking, as he...
Oh, he does every year, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, he doesn't do a lot, because it wasn't that long ago he's out with Contagion, his disaster movie. Here he's back with Haywire, which is his take on the female assassin action movie.
Oh, is it?
It stars real-life martial arts star Gina Carano as Mallory Kane, and she's going to be bumped off by Ewan McGregor's Kenneth when he hires Michael Fassbender as Paul the Assassin.
Resistance?
He won't be in a position to put a bullet in him, plant the brooch on him, and then kill her when you get back to the hotel.
Self-defense.
Of course.
I'm assuming the motives of everyone involved are strictly professional.
Paul, the motive is money. The motive is always money.
But you can't bump off a hero. I mean, it's very Nikita. It's very kind of running around. A lot of good music by David Holmes, kind of propulsive
score.
Yeah.
Out of sight.
And there's some good stuff in there. Some good action sequences where she kicks the living daylights out of some kind of, you know, Hispanics people. Antonio Banderas is in there.
Yeah.
And yet, it's this. I think it's halfway through this film where Soderbergh went, oh, do you know what? I need a couple of months, a years off. I can't stand this. He obviously did half of it and thought, I've got no idea what to do with this.
Well, isn't the thing with Soderbergh that he says you make one for the studio and then one for you? And if he made this immediately after Contagion, which is the one for him?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. It looks like he thought, well, she might be fun. She's not a great actress. She does okay. But
Likes the verite casting, though, because the Girlfriend Experience cast a real-life porn star.
Exactly. So he does do that, and he thinks perhaps it gives it that's what he's looking for, to give it a little gritty edge. And there's some nice scenes where she runs over rooftops through Dublin and stuff like that. It's just quite half-hearted as an action movie. I was really looking forward to it. I thought I could really do with some kind of kick.
From your synopsis as well, I have to say that the idea of Paul the Assassin doesn't exactly fill me with fear.
Paul the Assassin.
It's like, you know,
he's
Steve,
an Irish assassin.
Steve the Hitman.
He's not the most kind of, he's not the best assassin I've ever seen, to be honest. But it is another Michael Fassbender performance, and as such, it should not be notched down that I think it was five films he was in last year, and he's already started this year in another one. I wouldn't go mad for Haywire.
No.
I'm not going mad for Haywire.
All right.
What about The Sitter with Jonah Hill? Directed by
David Gordon Green. You know, one of the very more curious directing careers that's currently ongoing.
Because he started doing these
John
Washington.
He started with George Washington, a nice little art house film. Then he did All the Real Girls, which I liked a lot, which was...
Malickian kind of
Yeah,
meditation.
Very Malickian, very kind of indie, very slow burning. And so he started as the sort of art house geek and then turned suddenly, like some sort of Incredible Hulk figure, into Toga Yob, and started making films like Pineapple Express.
Which I like.
Yeah, and Your Highness, which you didn't like.
Which I didn't like.
I don't think you'd like this either. This is still him very much in Animal House, cavorting around. The Sitter stars Jonah Hill as Noah, who's a schlub who still lives home with Mom, who's press-ganged into babysitting a bunch of bratty kids, then agrees to pick up cocaine for his girlfriend, and of course, as you would, he takes the kids along for a ride.
Yeah, I like the sort of comic trope of the kind of useless adult in charge given the runaround by kids. I mean,
I like it, but my word, haven't we seen it?
Yeah, loads and loads. Like Elizabeth Shue was doing it back in the days. I kind of like this. I thought it was really dumb and stupid and rubbish, but I did laugh. I was very aware that I was the only person in the entire room laughing.
Yeah,
well, and I haven't had a lot of sleep.
It's not the best audience to see this kind of film with, is it?
No.
The National Press Show.
No. But there's a lot of people who are saying it's got racial stereotyping in it as well, because he kind of goes into black pool halls and things like that. But then it's all got this kind
and
of...
And you've got Sam Rockwell as the drug dealer with his cohorts who look like, you know, village people.
They are. Well, very well-built village people.
Very well-built village people.
There's a sort of thing, isn't there, that if you're a good actor, you can sort of get away in rubbish comedies. You can do the drug dealer. There's like Mark Wahlberg in that one with Tina Fey and Steve Carell.
Yeah, I still like Alfred Molina in Boogie Nights.
Yeah, you can do that.
Good.
Yeah, it's a good. You wear pants a lot and kind of get a
and you're probably
crazed.
You know, it's 2 days' work and it's a little vibrant firecracker of a cameo that everyone's going to remember.
I'm going to get me some drug dealer roles.
Yeah,
yeah.
Instead of the barman roles.
Yeah,
barman
exactly.
roles were so 2011.
I'm moving on up. I want to wear some pants. That's The Sitter with Jonah Hill, which, guiltily, I quite liked. Zan, thanks very much indeed. Coming this Monday, you'll have a chance to see a live stream on Guardian.co.uk by the great director Terry Gilliam, and our own Zan Brooks caught up with him to find out more.
Terry, I guess the truism that is that most directors start with short films as their calling card to then go on and make a feature, but you seem to be travelling in the opposite direction with The Holy Family. Is it like a kind of a new lease of life? Does this make you feel young again?
It's the end of my career, if you're doing it, you know.
No, I thought it was more Benjamin Button.
Well, there is that. I've always, from the beginning, whatever I do, if everybody's walking one direction, I like going the other direction. Not that it's right or better, it's just nobody else is peeking down that road. So, I mean, I didn't plan this. This happened. This was really the result of a man stalking me to my house in Italy and coming with a big box of pasta and saying they want to give me money to make a short film.
Terry Gilliam in conversation with our own Zan Brooks discussing pasta and film in his new short, The Holy Family, which will be streamed live and exclusive via guardian.co.uk this Monday, the 23rd of January at 1900 hours GMT. To find out more and take part in a live Q&A after the online streaming, just go to the best film site in the multiverse, guardian.co.uk/film. Back in the early 80s, collectives were all the rage. One of the most radical and inventive of them was the Black Audio Film Collective, which set out to create documentary from a black perspective, providing new views on the social turmoil of that time, but also innovating the form itself. A founding member of that group was the writer and filmmaker John Acomfra, who created one of the collective's most celebrated films, Handsworth Songs, in 1986. Over the years, John Acomfra's very idiosyncratic remix aesthetic, his use of archive and contemporary footage with an overdub soundtrack, has evolved, and this week sees the release of his latest work, The Nine Muses. It's a cinematic reinvention of Homer's Odyssey that encompasses Acomfra's key themes of identity, migration, and mythologies. And I'm delighted to say that John joins me in the Film Weekly studio now to help us try and unpack this incredibly layered and complex work. Welcome to Film Weekly, John.
Thank you, Jason.
Really great to see a film by you back on the big screens. The last time I saw a film by you, it was part of this film, but it was an installation in the gallery, the BFI. How did it become from an art piece into a kind of a full-blown film, if that's what we're calling this?
Yes, that's a good question. I mean, I think... How did it become a full-blown piece? I suppose it was in the middle of trying to do the installation when I thought, you know what, there's more to this than we've managed to get into, you know, the gallery. And the gallery piece was necessarily elliptical. It was necessarily kind of shorthand, if you like. So I spoke to my great friend Lizzie Frankie at the Film Council, and I said, "Look, I think there's a film of sorts in this. Would you support it?" Mm. And she said yes.
So. Because all the emotions that are in this film. Yes. We're in the installation, but it was a question of expanding, in some way, a narrative. But actually, you didn't really give it that much narrative.
No. Well, I mean, you know, having decided that the structuring device will be the nine muses, there really ain't any more.
Yeah, you give yourself, you know, you've got to tick off all those nine.
Quite. But we couldn't find any more to make it longer.
I'm going to give you a little testage on off the top of head. Do you know the nine muses?
I know the nine muses, but I couldn't tell you all their names. I know their functions,
right.
You know what I mean, which is slightly more important because the names are Greek and it's just difficult.
They're quite hard to do. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, so the one that you started with was, I'm terrible at pronouncing them,
Calliope.
Calliope is the first one that you start with, but your installation was based on
Nemesine.
Nemesine, there you go. It's really hard, I don't know why.
The Nemesine had to be the figure we started with, because, of course, Nemesine is the mother of the Nine Muses. And so I suppose a good way of describing the difference between the two is to say that the installation was about Nemesine, the goddess of memory, and the longer piece was much more about the daughters, the nine muses.
Yeah, it's almost how they fragmented in a way.
Yes.
In a sense, that narrative structure that you've given it is in a way a kind of reflection of the diaspora that has fragmented as well. Indeed. from the West Indies, from Africa, from India, and come here to Britain.
Yes. I mean, I think what you try to do when you're invited to do something like this, because I was, the BBC and the Arts Council had a scheme. They wanted an artist/filmmaker to look through the archives to see whether they could say anything else with them. And I thought there was something of value to be had from using familiar material to try and wrench a kind of new emotional currency or value out.
Sometimes we think we shouldn't blame the fever, because it's we who have come to your country. On the other hand, we think, well, if they in the first place had not come to our country and have spread a false propaganda, we would never have come to theirs. If we had not come, we would none be the wiser. We would still have the good image of England, thinking that they are what they are not. And the English would be ignorant of us.
I mean, some of it, you say familiar material, but I mean, when you give it a new framework and you put it in a new setting, it becomes unfamiliar in a way, haunting, thus.
Well, it's for me, the combination of things. I mean, everyone's heard some of those great Shakespeare, you know, soliloquies. Everyone's, I'm assuming, you know, read it, or at least been recited some Milton too at some point in their life.
There's Emily Dickinson and Joyce and Beckett as well.
You know, so they're not unfamiliar in themselves, but I think the combination of them plus the relocating of all of that into a new space, a space about the diaspora, that kind of makes it work for me anyway.
You were born in Ghana?
I was born in Ghana indeed, yeah.
And so you made that journey yourself. So there's obviously a sort of personal sort of aspect that filters into that. I mean, you weren't on, I don't know if you made it on a boat, but there's a lot of pictures of people arriving on the boats and the shipyards of England.
I mercifully didn't come on a boat because I can't start traveling in ships and boats. I always get seasick, so I didn't. I mean, I came when I was, I think, 5 and a half, and it was in the 60s, and I don't actually remember the trip, but I think it was by plane. Mm. I think it was by plane. But this isn't really about my generation, if you like. I'm really trying to do something with the memories of my mother's generation.
Yeah, I mean, that's the feeling you get, and what I thought was most striking about the nine muses was the feeling of empathy you get with that dislocation, with that exile, even though it was wished upon them. I don't think it were none of it was forced exile as such. But that it's that kind of arriving in this strange land. And England, it just looks really weird in those archive clips. The strangeness of black faces, Indian faces amid the snow of where it is, Birmingham and Ealing. I mean, it just looks so bizarre.
Well, when you speak to, and this is something I think all people who have, you know, forebears and or parents and grandparents from somewhere else do, you know, when you speak to them, you know, the sense of strangeness is the one thing that comes across very, very strongly and palpably in what they say. So if you speak to an old West Indian or African and you say to him, you know, what was it like when you first came here, you know, what they describe is almost a kind of science fiction journey. You know, it feels so strange. And of course, it was strange because, you know, effectively, you're moving from one part of the planet used to a different way of being, a different way of living time and experiencing the weather and all the rest of it to a completely different space.
And yet they wanted to go there.
Oh, absolutely.
Is there a disconnect between the image that was sold to them and the image that they got when they arrived?
No, I mean, I think that generation... as opposed to, you know, the migrants that you're now getting from Africa or the Caribbean and the Indian subcontinent, came because they felt they were connected to this place in some ways. I mean, you know, the phrase you heard from my mother's generation all the time was, oh, well, we came to the mother country. I mean, no, you know, West African coming here now comes with that sense of affinity with this place. So, you know, they certainly felt they were coming to the mother country. They were British subjects, after all, at that time, both legally and constitutionally. So they weren't foreigners. They were coming from one part of, quote unquote, the empire to another part. And I think, you know, clearly the sense of opportunity that this place offered was paramount, but it wasn't the only thing. I mean, that's the thing that I wanted to get across more than anything, which is that we've talked for too long about the economic imperatives or the demographic imperatives of migration. There were emotional undercurrents and imperatives which also need to be now understood.
Yeah, and that's really what comes out through your work, just through the agglomeration of images and sounds. I'm wondering why, I mean, as we mentioned Milton and Joyce and Emily Dickinson and the great poets, the great Western poets, white Western poets. There's not a lot of... I was expecting perhaps a bit of, you know, overlaid of African poetry on there, but you kept it kind of quite... And the actors are all kind of great English narrators, very kind of, you know, in a classic way. Was that the... To kind of add to the kind of off-kilter mix?
Yes and yes.
Oh, good. I worked that out.
You know... If you're Black British and you grew up in the 60s and 70s, then you would have been exposed to these writers and thinkers more or less the same time. So the sense that they are not your property was something that I've fought against all my life, really. Mm. I mean, you know, Milton, the great poet on Becoming, speaks about how we, and by we, he didn't mean just white people, how we became, you know. And so it seemed appropriate to me that those figures who've all been worrying about the premise of the film, which is how do people become new? How do you go from being one thing to the other? Most of these writers are obsessed with that, from Milton to Beckett. You know, and so I felt that they should be in there.
Yeah, no more Beckettian situation than to be transposed into an absurd situation, or an absurd universe from one to another. In fact, immigration is, I didn't realise it until I was listening to Beckett on yours, thinking, well, actually that is, it's like being stuck in Happy Days, or Happy End, sorry, his play. It's like being caught in there.
Exactly. I mean, and Beckett is the... diasporic voice par excellence, because he himself was writing all of this material in exile, as it were.
Yes, in Paris, Dublin, you know.
And a lot of that work is about this business of how you find a sense of a personal map, you know, in a universe that really doesn't immediately or automatically offer you one.
Yeah. There's not just archive material, though that must have been fascinating, kind of wading through that and putting it all together. There is a modern layer as well, a rather crisp HD kind of beautiful images of a tanker, which presumably you had to be aboard to take the pictures of if you're seasick. Yes. I don't know how you manage that, because you're going through the dark black waters of Alaska with these mysterious figures in blue and yellow anoraks. Was that you?
Yes, one of them's me.
Was it? And that it was almost, cold. What are you doing
almost,
up there?
It almost didn't happen, Chase. I was... I remember standing on the deck of one of these tankers thinking, okay, it's minus 15. Gale force winds are coming at me. My stomach feels like, well, you can imagine. What am I doing?
It's bad enough a Ghanaian boy comes to, you know, Stoke Newington and gets cold, but you don't need to go to Alaska as well.
No, quite. but it did strike me. It's strange because we looked around. We looked in several places because I wanted something that was not just uncomfortable for me, but a place that had a strange aesthetic beauty. And we went to Skye, Iceland, and I was in Alaska for something, and I thought, this is it.
Yeah.
This feels strangely beautiful, eerily forbidding and beautiful at the same time. And it must have something of the emotional gravitas to it that I've heard all my life when I speak to people of the Windrush generation. It feels a little bit, it doesn't look, but feels a little bit like what they've always described to me when I've asked them, you know.
So you felt that you and you capturing you in that landscape would be similar to the alienation that they felt arriving here.
Absolutely. It just, you know, I stood there and I felt completely out of place and yet strangely as if I belonged there. And that double sense of being attached and repulsed by a place seemed to me then to capture something of what it's the migrant experience in general.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
You know, when people leave.
Yeah. You've added a beautiful soundtrack to it as well, it was you working with
my sound designer, colleague and friend, Trevor Matheson, who's done everything I've worked on with me, really.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's kind of primordial. It's kind of Sigarossi in a way, do you know what I mean? Or even Jan Garbarecki.
Very much. Very much. These are obvious models and influences. But the most important influence is the Estonian composer, Avo Pärt, whose music I've been listening to now for 20, 25 years. And it's
big stacks on the ECM label, all in your house.
I've been told off about this.
Really?
Yes.
Get out on MP3.
A friend of mine told me off of using too much ECM. Everybody's using ECM these days. Well, you know.
You were there first.
I was.
You had the Coln concert before anyone else.
I did. And I love it.
John Le Coffre, it is an absolutely beautiful piece of work. Stunning, in fact. I hope people go and see it in the cinema because that probably is its proper place. And you would sort of sit in front of it. And what are you expecting from an audience? I mean, you had to pitch it. Obviously, it's not a huge budget, but you've had to pitch it and get it from the Arts Council, from Lizzie Frankie. Are they expecting audiences to go and see it? I mean, what's the best way for people
to
see it?
Well, I think they're expecting audiences to go and see it. Not of Hugo or Harry Potter proportions, but I think they're expecting an audience. I mean, I'm very easy about this. I know that it's not going to be the cup of tea of anyone who's, for Tintin, let's say. Mm. But I think and hope that it will find a niche that people who just want to go into a space to experience a different use of images.
But what I mean is that on the weekly release schedule, it's kind of an odd thing to, let's consider. I mean, it needs to kind of breathe and be there for a while, and people need to just come across it.
Yeah.
Can you do that in a cinema?
The hope is that it will play at the ICA for a bit and then just do that itinerant thing, the movies like this do, travel around the country, yeah, doing 2 days here and 3 days here.
A film about immigration, alienation, it should wander.
And migrate.
Forever and migrate. Yes. And we wish it luck on its journey. John Le Coffre, lovely to have you in the studio, and lovely to see The Nine Muses in Britain. I saw it first in Venice, where it kind of seemed right in the artistic setting there, and I hope it gets the same treatment here in Britain too.
Thank you, Jason.
And the beautiful The Nine Muses by John Le Coffre goes on release this Friday, the 20th of January. That's all for this week. Remember, for breaking film news day or night, just go to guardian.co.uk/film. From me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.